Yeah.
Okay, now that we've studied optics, we're in a position to talk about the two theories which pretty much revolutionized physics in the 20th century. What we've been studying up to now was pretty much worked out by the year 1900, and it's fine for figuring out things like, you know, what somebody's eyeglass prescription should be or how a generator works or so on. But the theory of relativity and quantum theory together were both developed in the last 100 years, and they really revolutionized the way we look at reality. To some extent also, they've had an influence on they've made possible some of the modern inventions. For example, our knowledge of how the atom and nucleus works would have been impossible without knowing relativity and quantum theory. Computers, transistors, the invention of those depend completely on quantum mechanics. Without quantum mechanics, we never have been able to build a computer. In the time we have remaining, we can't go on to great detail in these theories, but I think it's worth, it's very worthwhile for you to at least to have a taste of what they're like, to get some idea, sort of a working knowledge of what the basic ideas are. And today we're going to talk about the theory of relativity, and then again some more tomorrow. And then after that we'll be talking pretty much about quantum theory and the structure of the atom. Relativity the reason we think of it as being revolutionary is the theory of relativity has changed the way we think of space and time. You may have heard of space-time, relativity, and so forth. It's essentially what the nature of the distance between two points is, or the time is, what that is. The theory pointed out something that had not been suspected before, and that is that mass and energy are just different aspects of the same thing. That's the famous equation, E equals mc squared. Today, we'll probably be talking mostly about the space and time aspects of relativity and the basic ideas. We won't have time to say too much about the equivalence of mass and energy. You have a couple of homework problems for tomorrow, which are concerned with that, and so I think after you have a chance to read the book and try them, what I have to say perhaps will make a little more sense. But we probably won't get there, the mass and energy part of it today. As you, I'm sure, know, the author of the theory of relativity was Albert Einstein. And actually, Einstein was one of the leading developers of quantum theory as well. In fact, it might be, just as for a sense of historical perspective, let me just give you a 45-second sketch of Einstein's early life. He got his PhD in Germany a little bit before the year 1900, but he couldn't get an academic job at a university. In those days, instead of having slews of professors, each university had 8 professors about physics or something. And he couldn't get a job. So he ended up as a patent inspector in Switzerland. Essentially what he did people would send in patent applications, and Einstein would look at the application and see if it made scientific sense. But while he did this, he continued his interest in theoretical physics. And in the year 1905, when Einstein was 26 years old, he published 5 papers. And of those 5 papers, one was probably nothing special, but 2 of them contained the entire special theory of relativity. Another one suggested to scientists a way to determine Avogadro's number with precision which had never before been dreamed of. In those days, Avogadro's number, the number of molecules in a mole, wasn't known to much better than a factor of two. But Einstein wrote a paper which involved what you may have heard in chemistry, Brownian motion, if you haven't, fine. But essentially, he suggested by studying this phenomenon, one could measure Avogadro's number with great precision. And it turned out, 10 or 15 years after he made this suggestion, somebody else did it and won a Nobel Prize for physics just for doing that, for taking Einstein's suggestion. The remaining paper was one in which Einstein invented the photon, the basic quantum electromagnetic radiation, which was one of the key steps in the development of quantum theory. So in the year 1905, Einstein did quite a bit. And interestingly enough, he won the Nobel Prize for physics, and he won the prize for his invention of the photon. He didn't win it for the theory of relativity, which presumably would have merited it. Actually, neither of the two theories, the idea of photons or the theory of relativity, were accepted by very many people until 15 or 20 years had gone by. Einstein wrote these papers in 1905, and it was the 1920s before people became convinced that, yeah, he was right. I said that the fact that we're through studying optics now puts us in a position to discuss these theories. And that's certainly true of relativity, because light plays a central role in the theory of relativity. Einstein was concerned with the behavior of light. He was interested in the various features of light. Although, more generally, what relativity is really about is the question of what two different people in motion with respect to another, relative to one another, when they look at something happening, or they measure something, the distance between two points, or the time between two events, the question is, what do these two guys get if they're in relative motion? And his starting place was, at least a technical term, which we'll use quite a bit, which we might as well define now, is that if you have two observers in relative motion, they're said each to occupy a frame of reference, or a reference frame. We're all at rest with respect to one another, so we can be thought of as occupying a frame of reference. For the mathematically inclined, we could put a coordinate origin over that corner, and so then we all have different x, y, and z coordinates in our reference frame. But by definition, we're in the same reference frame because we're at rest with respect to one another. But now, suppose I walk by you this way, or maybe it was a car and a coastline. I'm now in a different reference frame because I'm moving with respect to you. Of course, I could carry my own coordinate system along with me. You know, if I'm coasting along like this, I could say, you know, my coordinate system is moving like that. I'm at rest in my reference frame. But of course, when I look back, I see you guys moving down. You know, so basically, we now have the two reference frames because I'm in relative motion with respect to you, and vice versa. Okay, now, it turns out that Newtonian mechanics, classical mechanics, has built into it a feature which is very useful and certainly simplifies things. And that is to say, if you are in a so-called inertial frame of reference, and we'll define that a little more in a moment, in any inertial frame of reference, the Newton's laws of mechanics work perfectly well. An inertial frame of reference just means one that's not accelerating. So for example, you could say, if we're just sitting here, I mean, the Earth's going around the sun, so there's a small acceleration, but if we just sort of think, you know, the Earth's sort of sitting here, we're in an inertial frame now, and if I move past you, moving at constant speed in a straight line, so I'm not accelerating, I'll be in an inertial frame. A reference frame which is not inertial would be, for example, if I were in a car which would be going around a corner. Then what would happen is I'd see things that look like they'd be pushed against the outer door, because I'm in a non-inertial frame. You know, basically there's no force pushing them out, but they want to go straight. And so, and if I continued in an inertial frame, the objects would just sort of continue with me. When I turn this way, I'm in an accelerated frame, and try to go straight. And so it looks to me like they're But anyway, if you're in any inertial frame, the laws of Newtonian physics work just fine. And what that means is that you can assume you're at rest in your own frame by definition. And you can assume you're at rest, and there's no experiment in mechanics you can do which will contradict that assumption. So let's take a concrete example to see what I mean. Suppose I'm in, something coasting along like this at constant velocity, and I throw a ball at you. Okay, now, what you see, because I'm moving, is I throw the ball in the air, and I catch it. And of course, from your point of view, the ball is passing me like that. It obeys Newton's second law, F equals ma. Downward force causes there to be an acceleration. It has an initial upward velocity this way. And so, applying Newton's law, I should say, well, what it will do is this. Fine. But now, from my point of view, in my reference frame, I'm at rest. You guys are moving now. But I just throw the ball straight up. Well, once again, F equals ma in my frame, too. But it, in my frame, it has an initial velocity like that, but no horizontal velocity. So it just goes straight up and straight down. But neither you nor I is especially entitled to say, I'm the one who's at rest and you're moving. Basically, either one of us could say, I'm at rest and apply the laws of mechanics and they'll work just fine. Einstein was very impressed with this principle. Actually, people before Einstein had noted it also, and it was called the principle of relativity. Essentially, that the laws of mechanics work equally well in any inertial frame of reference. Einstein felt that this must be some fundamental underlying simplicity of nature that it's telling us something. And so what he wondered was, well, should this be true not just of the laws of mechanics, but how about, say, the laws of electricity and magnetism? And there seemed to be a problem when he did that. Because it appeared that the way the laws of electricity and magnetism were being interpreted in 1905, it appeared that not all inertial frames work on an equal footing, that there was one special inertial frame, and only that one could be considered to be at rest. And to illustrate where the problem comes, let's just think about light. You remember that according to Maxwell's theory, the speed of light in a vacuum, you can calculate from epsilon naught and mu naught, and when you do the calculation, you come out with 3 × 10⁸ meters per second. Okay. But now the question is, the light can travel through a vacuum, so the question is 3 × 10⁸ meters per second with respect to what? See, the vacuum is nothing. Suppose you're floating out here in space and a light pulse goes past you and you measure its speed and you say, 3 × 10⁸ meters per second. Fine, Maxwell was right. But what if you have some friend that is moving this way at 2/3 c, 2 × 10⁸ meters per second, and he looks at the same light pulse and he measures the speed of the light pulse with respect to him? Would he get 3 × 10⁸ meters per second? Well, you'd say probably no, because he's moving and you're at rest. But you see, if we wanted to apply this so-called principle of relativity to the theory of light, we'd have to assume that neither one of you could say that you're the one that's rest and the other's moving. Each person should be entitled to say that he's the one that's at rest, period. Apply the laws of electricity and magnetism, and everything should turn out all right. Okay? And so, what Einstein did was, feeling that this principle of relativity really was a powerful principle, he said, despite common sense, what we will assume is, we will simply make 2 postulates. One of them is that the principle of relativity applies to all laws of physics, including those of electricity and magnetism. In other words, no matter which frame of reference you're in, you can assume you're at rest, do any experiment you like, make any measurement you like, and there'll be nothing to tell you that you're moving. The fact that absolute motion is essentially meaningless. And essentially, every day. We sort of assume that. Now, here we are. We're at rest here. But, of course, we're on the Earth. The Earth's moving around the Sun. The Sun's moving with respect to distant planets and so forth. But basically, what Einstein said was, well, if you're in an inertial frame of reference, anything you do, nothing you do, rather, can tell you that you're moving. Now, what does that mean? Well, I said he made two postulates. Well, the first postulate of relativity is simply this so-called principle of relativity. And one way of putting it is that all the laws of physics work equally well in any inertial frame of reference. And another way of putting it is the concept of absolute motion, so-called, whether that you're definitely moving or not, absolute motion is a meaningless concept. No way to tell that you're moving. You can assume you're at rest. Second postulate was to make sure that this first postulate would work when you were talking about light. Einstein was a great admirer of Maxwell, who of course is the fellow who would, you know, they predicted the existence of electromagnetic waves and the fact that light should have this definite speed. And essentially to say Maxwell's theory, what Einstein postulated was that anybody in any inertial frame of reference looking at a light pulse or any electromagnetic wave, when he measures the speed of that light relative to him, if it's in a vacuum, he's got to get the value C. If he doesn't, he could tell he's moving. For example, see, let's compare this with what happens if you were measuring the velocity of the sound. Let's say the speed of sound is 750 miles an hour. Okay, so let's say that the sound wave that goes past is 750 miles an hour that way. Speed, that's what it is. And now let's say there's some other guy who's flying along at 500 miles an hour the same way, and he looks at the sound wave, and what he would see is it's moving 250 miles an hour faster than he is, you know, away from him. But you see, this is a little bit, this situation is a little different than what Einstein was talking about. In the case of sound, it travels through the air, and the guy in the plane is moving with respect to the guy standing on the Earth is not. And so naturally, so since the sound moves, you know, at 750 miles per hour with respect to the Earth, if you're moving through the air, you can tell you're moving by measuring the speed of sound. But what Einstein's saying is, well, in the case of light, a vacuum, we shouldn't be able to tell the movement. And certainly, if I look at a light bulb and I see it's not going 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second, I'll know I'm moving. For example, if I look at it and I see it's only going at 2 times 10 to the 8 meter per second this way, that'll tell me I'm moving at 1 times 10 to the 8 the same way. Or if I see a light pulse coming in this way and it's moving at 5 times 10 to the 8 meter per second, that must mean I'm moving at 2 times 10 to the 8 meters per second the other way, right? But what he says is, if it's really true that all frames of reference are on an equal basis, everybody's got to get the same value. The speed of light. And of course, this doesn't, you know, when the light goes through glass and slows down, now that's another matter because it's moving relative to the glass and so forth. But when we're looking at light or any electromagnetic in a wave in the vacuum, it has the same value, namely C. When measured in any frame, measured in any, at least any inertia frame. Those are the two postulates. And, you know, there they are. Now, this second postulate, even though in a way it was made to rescue the first one, that's the one which defies common sense. Because again, you see, what that says is, if I'm floating here in space, and I look at a light pulse go by, and I measure its speed, 3 × 10⁸ meters per second, some other guy heading at 2 × 10⁸ meters per second with respect to me, in the same direction of the light, I can see the light's gaining on him at a rate of 1 × 10⁸ meters per second. And he looks at that light, he's got to get 3 × 10⁸. He can't tell that he's the one that's moving. Now, let's see what the consequences of that are. And in fact, why don't we just take a simple example of what I was talking about. Let's say that we have two guys who are going to be in relative motion. We'll give this guy a name, we'll call him A. And let's say there's some guy named B who goes by in a rocket ship at some high speed. And in fact, actually it'll turn out to be useful. C is 3 × 10⁸ meters per second, but it gets to be something of a drag to write 10⁸ all the time. So let's just make a note that this is really the same thing as 300 meters per microsecond, because a microsecond is 10⁻⁶ seconds, right? So if it goes 300 million meters per second, it'll go 300 meters per minute per second. And let's say this guy, B, is traveling at 2/3 C. So that would be 200 meters per microsecond. And let's say at the instant that B goes in by A, there's this light bulb traveling at C, which of course is 300 meters per microsecond. Okay. Now, let's say these guys have got really quick reflexes and precise clocks and everything. And let's say they each wait for a microsecond after what I've drawn here. And let's ask what they see. So what A would see is in 1 microsecond, B is down here. And obviously he's 200 meters away, since in 1 microsecond he moved 200 meters. The light is 300 meters away because it was traveling at 300 meters per microsecond. Okay, fine. So this is after, you might say this is a T minus, according to A. But now, what does B see? According to B, he can consider himself at rest. And so what he saw, he was sitting here. And what he saw was the light went this way, and A was actually going this way, relative to him, right, at 200 meters per microsecond, back the other way. And he has, according to B, the speed of the light has to be 300 meters per microsecond relative to him also, in his reference, right? So he waits a microsecond. And after a microsecond, the light's 300 meters per second. This way, this is T, 1 microsecond, according to B. And after 1 microsecond, A is over here. This is 100 meters away. So after 1 microsecond, according to A, the distance between A and the light bulb is 300 meters. The distance between A and B is 200 meters. Okay? And the distance between B and the light bulb is 100 meters. But according to B, the distance between A and the light bulb is not 300 meters, it's 500 meters. So, you see, if we force the speed of the light to have the same value in both these frames of reference, something has to give. And the something that has to give is our conception of distance and time. If it's true that everybody must measure the same speed for light in all reference frames, they cannot get the same value for the distance between two points or the time between two events. although classically we've thought of, you know, the distance between between him and me is 10 feet. Well, it's 10 feet in this frame of reference, but in other frames of reference it's something else. Distance does not have a definite value. It depends upon the frame of reference from which it's measured. The same thing is true of time. Now, I'm going to show you a brief little film clip that takes about 5 minutes. Let me just, before I show it to you, let me just mention that in your textbook, they talk about two of the major consequences for space and time we've talked about. And I want to just summarize them because then in this film clip we'll talk about them a little bit. One is a phenomenon known as time dilation. And what that says is, if there's a clock which is moving at some high speed with respect to you, and it measures a certain time, you know, 1 minute or 1 second or whatever, and you measure the time interval in your clock, delta t, it goes by while you watch this one register delta t zero. This clock runs slow, as seen by you. Delta t, the time that you say goes by, is 1 over the square root of 1 minus b squared over c squared, times the time it goes by. And since this square root inside here is always less than 1 minus something, the delta t measured here would be larger than that. This delta t zero is called the proper time. It's the time interval measured by a guy who's sitting there looking at that clock. The clock's at rest with respect to him. And then when we watch that clock moving by, it ticks in different places it moves along. It's moving. And we measure a larger time that goes by than this guy here. There's a second effect discussed in your text, which is essentially the flip side of the same coin. You can't have one without the other. And what this says is that if you have some guy going past you with, let's say, a ruler, like this, the length of the ruler, so let's call it L0. This one is called the proper length. It's the proper length because this guy is measuring it here. The ruler is at rest with respect to him. Really, of course, what the length is, it's essentially the distance between two points along this guy's x-axis. That's the x-axis. Okay? And what happens is, if we watch this thing go by, we will see that this distance is not what this guy is. Look at a length L, which is equal to L0, times the square root, which means that it's shorter because this is less than 1. So, two of the major effects are that when you watch clocks or other events happening, when you watch things happen in a frame moving relative to you, you see that the time is slowed down. Time literally doesn't move at the same rate as it does in your reference frame. You also see all distances along the direction of relative motion shortened by this factor. There's another effect which this little film clip will show you, which we won't try to calculate or anything, and that's simply the fact that time flows at different rates in different frames of reference means, or actually has a corollary, says in a given frame of reference, you can have two things happen at the same time, and in some other frame of reference, they may not happen at the same time. So in other words, if two firecrackers go off, one at this end of the bench and one at the other, and they go off at the same instant in our frame of reference, if somebody moving by, either this way or that way, they will not go off at the same time. It depends on the way they're moving. Guy moving this way sees one go off before the other, guy moving that way would see just the opposite, the other goes off. Okay, we won't go into that. That's a little too much for us to consider. But let's look at our little film clip. They talk about that, and then they show you how this time dilation comes about. So let me turn these lights down so we can see what's going on here. There. Now, I always forget You know, I turn all the lights off, then I can't find any knob. You know, it's the same damn thing. Somewhere I gotta have a watch. Okay. There we go. All right. See, I gotta turn this thing on. Okay, let's see. Now, we try this. Well, see, well, you know, I never have been very good at this. Let's see, where is my, okay, it's like this. And let's try playing this thing. Let me get started here. Let's try the other thing. Okay, it's time for rescue. Let's get the. Hey guys, I need an update on the video start. Let me stop it. How irritating. This thing's kind of. See, what you have to do, you have to aim it really right at this stupid thing. Okay, let's not waste it. We don't have the time to waste our. I'll show you what they were going to show you. I'm not going to show you the movie on Friday. This time dilation effect, moving clocks run slow. Here's the basic argument, and they go through something like this in the text, so you can look at it there also. The device they use is a fairly contrived device. It's called a light clock. And what it consists of is you have two parallel mirrors, and somehow, from somewhere, you get a light pulse, and let the light pulse bounce back and forth between the mirrors. And, you know, that every time the light pulse goes from one mirror to another, that's a certain time, whatever the distance is divided by C. So the light pulse ticks and talks and so forth, like that. And what we're going to do is we're going to compare the rate at which a light clock runs when it's just sitting here at rest with respect to us, and what happens when it moves by at high speed. So let's say that we keep our own light clock right here, but we let another light clock move this way some fairly high speed v. And let's say the light pulse is just leaving this bottom mirror. Okay, but now, in order for the light to stay in the clock, this moving clock, I mean, somebody's riding along this with this, and you know, he can see the light going up and down, the guy that's riding along. But from our point of view, in order for the light to stay in the clock, it has to follow a certain sawtooth pattern. Like that. It has to move not only this way, but that way to keep up with the clock. And by the time it gets back to the bottom here, it has to do that. So, according to the guy at rest with respect to the clock, the light just had to go from here to here, and then back again. But according to us, the light had to go from here over to there to stay in the clock. You know, and basically both of these light clocks are identical. But, and you know, in its own reference frame, the light clock, the watch is doing that. And our frame is doing this. Now, classically, we would say that, well, you know, because this guy's moving, in order for the light to stay in a clock and keep constant time, the light would have to travel faster than it does when the clock's at rest to keep up with the clock. But you see, according to the second postulate, the speed of light is the same in both reference frames. So in other words, if this guy at rest with respect to the clock says it takes a time delta t zero for the light to go from here to here, we would say the light also traveling c takes some longer time, c delta t, to go between the same two mirrors. And see, we have to assume the speed of light is the same. Of course, while this time delta t goes by, in our reference frame, this clock moves with respect to s, the distance b delta t. But you see, the gist of this is, we'll do the algebra in a moment, and it's easy to get this expression I wrote down for you. But the gist of it is, essentially, that in this moving light clock, the light has to travel further to reach the second mirror, and yet it has to travel at the same speed in this frame, and so this clock doesn't run slow. Okay, and we can just use the Pythagorean theorem to figure out how much. Well, essentially, if I just take the hypotenuse squared, c squared delta t squared, that's equal to the sum of the two sides squared, b squared delta t squared, plus c squared delta t naught squared. And let's solve for delta t naught squared. So I'll just take c squared minus b squared all times delta t squared. On this side of the equation, that's c squared delta t naught squared, which means that if I want to solve for delta t squared now, well, let me just divide through by c squared. And then what I'll get is 1 minus d squared over c squared delta t squared. That should equal delta t naught squared. In shorter time, and this, there's still parentheses here. And so the equation I wrote down on the board several minutes ago, taking the square root, it just says delta t is delta t naught over this square root factor, 1 minus d squared over c squared. And this is always greater than delta t naught, the so-called proper time. By the way, this effect, of course, the entire theory of relativity, after all these years, there have been plenty of opportunities to check it, and every time it's been checked, it's been correct. This particular effect of time dilation has been observed over and over and over again in the Life Laboratory. When V is not too large compared to C, V squared over C squared will be essentially zero at everyday speeds, and so there won't be a noticeable difference. But as V becomes close to C, 1 minus b squared over c squared starts to become a fairly small number, and the clock will really start to run slow. And in the laboratory, high-speed particles are created in collisions, which, when they're at rest or moving slowly, have an average lifetime. When they move at high speeds, close to the speed of light, they live many times longer, and it's because of this time dilation factor. Many experiments wouldn't work if the particles didn't live longer because they are traveling so close to the speed of light. This factor here, 1 over the square root factor, appears very often. And so it's very customary. If you have any other book that you look at, you'll find that the Greek symbol gamma, the Greek letter gamma, by definition, is 1 over this square root factor. And so gamma is always greater than or equal to 1. It would be equal to 1 if something were moving. But essentially, in this language, which if you've been using another text to look at occasionally, in this language, delta t that you mentioned would be gamma, 1 over the square root factor, times the proper time, delta t 0. So this would be greater than the time. Now, one of the things to be careful about here, and applying that equation, is to know which one's the delta t zero and which one's the delta t. Which one's the proper time and which one's the longer time. The proper time is measured by a clock at rest with respect to u, or if there are two things that happen, those two things happen at the same point. You know, let's say a firecracker goes off and then 5 seconds later, it goes off, another one goes off at the same place. You would measure the time interval 5 seconds between. That's the proper time. But if somebody watched you going by them at high speed, they would see that instead of 5 seconds going by, some longer time would go by. Factor of gamma, longer. Now, I said that this second effect, the fact that distances along the direction of motion are contracted by the square root factor, is really the flip side of the coin. It's really the same effect in a way. And to see that that's true, let's think of this situation. Suppose there's again, there are two guys in relative motion, so we'll put one here in the ground. Sitting here with his clock, light clock or any other kind of clock. And let's say there's this guy in a rocket ship. He has a moving clock. And just to illustrate the point here, let's try some numbers. Let's say that B here is 0.8C. C is 300 meters per microsecond, so that would be 240 meters per microsecond. Let's say that's how fast this clock is moving. And let's say that just when this clock registers zero, starts to tick, there's a flagpole right underneath it, and then there's a flagpole down the path here. And let's say that according to this guy here, the distance between these two flagpoles, which will be the so-called proper distance because they're at rest with respect to him. Let's say that this distance happens to be 1,200 meters. And let's ask, well, okay, according to this guy on the ground, how long does it take the rocket to go that 1,200 meters? Well, that's simple enough. You know, it's 1,200 meters divided by 240 meters per microsecond. Each microsecond, it goes 240. So in this guy's frame of reference, L of T will just be this L of T. 1,200 divided by 240 meters per microsecond. And it turns out, if you do the arithmetic here, this turns out to be 5 microseconds. So in other words, you know, it takes 5 microseconds for the ship to go 1,200 meters going at 240 microseconds. Okay, but remember that the clock here in the ground is not running the same rate as the clock on the ship. And in fact, what we know is that if this guy measures delta T, this guy up here with the clock moving with respect to him is going to measure some shorter time, because this time is long. And essentially, this delta T is this factor of M times delta T zero. And this is what's the 5 microseconds. So basically, the time that this guy on the ship says goes by is not 5 microseconds, it's delta T divided by M. Or delta T times that square root factor, because gamma is 1 over the square root factor. So, for example, we could ask, well, what does this guy in the rocket see? Well, you know, not as much time goes by. And what does that mean? What's the consequence that follows if this guy's looking at those flagpoles? He's sitting here at rest, and the flagpoles are moving by at 240 meters per microsecond. He's moving this way with respect to the flag, so they're moving that. And let's take a number. The gamma here, the square root factor, gamma is 1 over the square root factor. If V is 0.8C, the square root factor is 1 minus 0.8 squared. 0.8C over C squared. 1 minus 0.64 is 0.36. Take the square root, it's 0.6. So this gamma factor, 1 over the square root factor, is 1 over 0.6. That's 1 over 3/5, so let's just call it 5/3.
1 2/3.
Okay? So, apparently, what this guy on the rocket sees, the time of delta T0, is shorter by this factor of gamma. So it's the 5 microseconds divided by 5/3, or only 3 microseconds. But now look what that must mean. This guy's looking at these flagpoles go by, and it only takes 3 microseconds from the time the first one goes by for the second one to go by. And they're traveling at the 240 meters per microsecond, but that one to the right only has 3 microseconds to make it to him. So the distance between those flagpoles has got to be shorter. In fact, this distance, L, which in this case would be measured by the guy in the rocket, as he watches these things go by, L must be basically the V of the flagpoles multiplied by, or divided by, L0 over M. L0 divided by this quantity gamma, or L must equal this L0 times the square root factor. The square root factor was 0.6 or 3/5. So in our example, L, the distance the guy in the rocket sees between the flagpole, is L0, which was 1,200 meters, multiplied by 0.6. Which I believe is 720. So, although the guy who is at rest with respect to the flagpole says they're 1,200 meters apart, the people on the rocket who watch them moving back say that distance is contracted to 720 meters. If this distance contraction didn't work, the time dilation would lead to an inconsistent result. I mean, you know, this guy aboard the ship says 3 microseconds goes by, not 5 microseconds. And so the distance between the flagpole can't be 1,200 meters. There's an interesting possibility that this raises. Technically, it's not possible. But it has to do with long-distance space flight. The nearest star, Alpha Centauri, is something like 5 light years from Earth, which means that it's the distance that light travels in 5 years, so it's a very big distance. And so even if you could accelerate a rocket ship up close to the speed of light, it would take 5 years to go there. Most stars are much further. They can be hundreds, thousands, or even billions of light years away. And so one question is, well, you know, if we wanted to send a crew of astronauts to a distant star, would they die of old age before they got there? And the answer is not necessarily, if we get the ship going fast enough. For example, suppose that we get a rocket ship going so fast that this square root factor is 0.1 of the gamma, and over 0.1 is 10. And let's say, so the speed will be very close to the speed of light then, and let's say there's a star 100 light years away, and the ship is moving close to the speed of light. How long does it take to reach the star? About 100 years, moving at the speed of light. That's from the Earth's frame of reference. According to the ship, the star and the Earth are rushing past it, and that distance is contracted by that same factor of 10. So the people aboard the ship say, well, the star isn't 100 light years away, it's only 10 light years away. And so it'll only take 10 years to get there, or for us to reach it. Actually, it turns out that if you were to calculate what it would cost to accelerate even a small rocket ship to anything close to the speed of light, it would far exceed the gross domestic product of the US. So maybe we could get the residents of the star to pay the return trip. It's energetically, there's an economic problem. Okay, it's time to stop. Let's stop.